The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Well, welcome back. July 7th. If it's the third hour on a Tuesday, you know we're going to talk COVID with our in-house resident experts. And today we're one man short, but no worries. Lewis Hallman is with us. He is the managing director of Insight Analytics. His website, InsightAnalyticsLLC.com. Insight is spelled I-N-C-I-T-E. And let me start this way with you, Lewis. There's so much to talk about coronavirus stories in Arizona and about Arizona. But the thing I was thinking about coming into the studio today, I wanted to run by you, is, you know, I actually don't know your politics. I hope we agree on things, or at least we don't disagree to the point that it is too terribly meaningful. But a lot of us have been talking about the lack of good journalism for many, many years, and the partisan nature of journalism, and the laziness of journalism. For many, none of this mattered too terribly much until it came to COVID. And we finally see in sharp relief a lot about what a lot of us have been talking about. The journalist community is simply not doing their job, especially in Arizona. Would you comment on that?
Sure. So let me actually, instead of diving right into it, let me push back a little bit and say that I don't think that journalists have ever actually been very good. You know, we're taught in school about yellow journalism and all of these other issues. And then for some reason the trend isn't continued into the present, as if those issues somehow were magically solved or gone, it went away around the time of Watergate. And so my question is, I suppose, to that is, like, can you point me an instance when journalism has ever been very, very good and hasn't served couched into institutional interests?
Yeah, third hours on Tuesdays here.
Right. You know, fair enough. Fair enough. And so, but I do agree. I think that the press has really just absolutely messed up the story, and they continue to do so. And it's for a lot of data structural reasons. You know, these guys are not trained statisticians in some sense, so.
But neither am I, and I understand what you're talking about, and it doesn't need to, you don't need a trained statistician. A lot of people are doing their own homework and saying, you know, this doesn't gel. We have who was it in the Arizona Republic today? Elvia Diaz was talking about the sky falling because Arizona this week surpassed 100,000 known COVID-19 cases. The rest of the country is reporting on Arizona as having its sky falling. Would you like to put all this in perspective for us, please?
Sure. So, you know, it is true that we've passed 100,000 COVID cases. We've actually, over the past 2 weeks, I think, we have found 64,000 of those COVID cases, roughly. And this is predominantly due to the fact that we are testing much, much, much more than we used to be. You know, if you think about the fact that the last 10 days of tests are equal to the first, like, 2.5 months of testing, it starts to put some of this into perspective a little bit. The one variable that I think is really best looked at and held constant is daily mortality data.
Because cases don't tell you a damn thing.
Well, they don't tell you the same thing over time is the real issue with it, right? And so, you know, one case, you know, 2 months ago under a very thin testing regime is not the same as a case now. And the same is even true of other variables like tests themselves or, you know, how many hospital beds are full, because, you know, we have to control for how we're looking at the landscape, because if we're not doing that, then we're liable to, you know, focus in on all sorts of spurious trends and other issues. The reason that I like deaths, though, again, is that, you know, they don't change. But the really curious part about that and sort of all of the daily excitement today is that AZDHS came out with 117 new deaths today, which would be the highest increase on record.
Okay.
And that, you know, scared and surprised a lot of people, and the press has been running their usual, the sky is falling, the sky is falling nonsense with it. And the issue that I have with that is that in the prior 2 days, right, that would be the 5th and the 6th, AZDHS listed a total of 6 deaths over the 2 days. And so that would be like if your job was to sort of record car accidents, right? And you did that every day and you submitted how many car accidents there were, and then you took a couple days off, and then rather than like backfiling your reports for those days, you just turned in all of the missing car crashes as one day's event. And then you said, oh my God, it's a new epidemic of car crashes, and it's just that that's patently untrue. The other thing I think that really, you know, to put a bow on it, much of the corporate media, I think, has the curse of being factual but not truthful.
Okay. Okay.
Right? Where they're very...
It is a fact that we have 100,000 known COVID-19 cases.
Right.
That's a fact.
It is also a fact that we've discovered most of them recently. But if you, you know, treat it as if it's the same type of information that we were receiving in April, it's certainly not true. That's not true. It's not, because we're now testing at about 6.5-7 times the rate that we were in April and May. You know, it's really gone up dramatically in the intervening periods. And so, you know, trying to keep everyone scared and on the back foot just by pumping out angry looking statistics is really not a very useful way to inform a society. But it's a very useful way to, you know, keep one cowed and to potentially get them voting the way that you would like.
One of the funny things about this is there's no winning. A lot of conservatives, a lot of libertarians are upset with the governor. Equally so, or even more so, the left is upset with the governor. For example, in this Diaz op-ed today in the Arizona Republic, she's saying, why isn't the governor sprinting into action? For example, she cites that things are so bad, I'm quoting her, things are so bad that COVID-19 patients in Tucson are being transferred to Phoenix and out of state due to shortages in beds, equipment, or staffing. All you hear about Arizona are that their hospitals are practically full or overflowing. Can you put that into context for us?
Absolutely. So it is true that the number of patients in hospitals who have COVID, that number is increasing over time, and it's been increasing more or less for the past, you know, since the pandemic started, really. What is not true is that our hospitals are necessarily more filled. For instance, you know, the high point was on June 23rd, in terms of inpatient beds occupied. And since then, we actually have about 250 to 300 fewer beds filled. The issue is that more of them have COVID patients in them. But it's not immediately clear what this means, right? So one of the issues is that hospitals have gone from testing just patients with respiratory issues and who otherwise might be susceptible or have COVID to instituting a universal testing regime. And that allows them to capture asymptomatic, low-symptom patients that aren't at the hospital for that specific purpose. That then allows them to count them in part of their figures, and the plus can then gleefully report that we are seeing the end of days when the death figures don't entirely bear that out.
One of the problems with just talking about cases, though, is it, and I want to go back to this question that you were kind of good at helping me correct, is when you have so many more cases, the thing that the media isn't reporting is that the mortality rate is falling consonant with the increase in cases. You would think we would hear that. You would think we would want to know that, wouldn't you?
Well, if...
Because if how did someone put it? If a tree falls in the forest and no one's harmed or injured, it's not worth talking about very much. But that's what we're getting with just these numbers of cases. They have no color to them.
So philosophically, I'm a bit of a consequentialist. And so, you know, if you ask me, you know, if you wanted to inform the public, you know, wouldn't you be telling them all of these things that actually inform them? And so in some sense, you know, I agree with you. Like, if that were my goal, that would be what I'm doing. But we're not seeing that. And so that sort of leaves me with this ugly, resting, ruminating question of, so what is the goal? Mm-hmm. You know, why are we not getting clarity? Why are we only getting obfuscation? And, you know, it comes down, I think, a lot to political hackery. It comes down to the fact that it's an election season. And I don't see any complaint that we do snapping the press to their senses and magically getting them to behave better is my issue.
So when we're told, well, the hospitals are overflowing, our response is?
Well, our response should be, you guys should count your surge capacity. You're missing 600 ICU beds and 2,600 inpatient beds in the AZDHS statistics. It would be nice if those were counted. You know, that might be more truthful rather than emphasizing factual, as it were. So, for instance, if you add those actual beds in that are missing, those 600 ICU beds and the 2,600 inpatient beds, you get empty bed rates of 38.5% today for inpatients and 34% for ICU. We've got over a third of the capacity open.
You would think a good reporter would want to report that. You would think. But one, then again, yes, one would think.
We would be wrong, though, in this case.
You would think, but you would be wrong. I'm Seth Leibson. He's Lewis Hallman. 602-508-0960 is the number. 602-508-0960. That's how you're not supposed to say it. 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Beautiful. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, 602-508-0960. Lewis Hallman is our guest. He is the managing director of Insight Analytics, InsightAnalyticsLLC.com. Insight is spelled I-N-C-I-T-E, InsightAnalyticsLLC.com. It's his company and where you can get information that he posts, that he talks about here. Andy Biggs is with us, Lewis, in trying to provide some perspective. He tweeted out yesterday, the percent of Arizona's COVID-19 cases that are hospitalized fell again to 5%. A month ago, the number was 11%. So while we're told that we're getting these increasing numbers of the coronavirus in Arizona, I think it would, again, be important for people to understand, but 95% are not even worthy of hospitalization.
That's exactly right. And that number, to be fair, does also depend. You can fractionate that further depending
sure.
on what age group
yeah,
you're
absolutely.
In.
Absolutely. Talk to me about age groups. This is the big one, right? Because Andy was on earlier today, and we were talking about that 20 to 44 age range, which is what everyone seems to be freaking out about.
Right. It's sort of unintelligible to me, being a member of that age group,
okay.
why you're all so radically concerned for our
okay.
safety. And so Let me try and put it this way.
Okay.
So, you know, the hospitalization rate of people who are aged 20 to 44 is only 1.9%.
Do that again.
The hospitalization rate for people aged 20 to 44 is 1.9%.
It would be Maricopa
County.
AZ Central would report that.
And 2.2% across the state as a whole.
Okay.
So, you know, this sort of all really goes back to the issue about how I was talking in the prior segment that I only really like deaths as a constant variable
right.
because they mean the same thing every time.
Right.
And the issue is because cases don't mean the same thing and that we discover a different proportion of them daily, I think of COVID sort of as like, I don't know, it's almost like a plumbing problem, right? There's an amount of flow of water or something representing a volume of cases that are happening. All testing really does is it lets us sort of skim into that flow and try and get a measurement of how fast the water is moving, but we can't really do that perfectly. So that, you know, in April, if we were only measuring, say, a very, very small percentage of the testing that we're doing now, then, you know, our ability to see how much is actually happening has increased. But a consequence of that will mean that we'll be recording vastly more cases than we used to for every death, for every hospitalization, and all of these other issues. And so all of these rates, the big, bad, scary rates of ill portents and bad consequences, they're all collapsing, and they have been since the start of this thing. You know, I recall back when the COVID case fatality rate was something like 20%. Now it's 1.83% across
That's
right. the
state. That's right. That's right. It's 1.83%. A month ago, it was 4.4%. So again, the case fatality rate is falling. You would think we should know that. You would think that
right.
that would be something that people would want to know. That's the thing about the media. They never tell you what you want to know.
Well, they tell you what they want you to know
is the issue. Right.
You know, it's again, this sort of factual versus truthful kind of dichotomy that they like to run themselves in. As long as they're like, you know, you can publish an article, and as long as you aren't blatantly lying about it, you know, you can get traction. And that's sort of the issue with these complex figures as well. If you've got 8 or 10 different metrics we can talk about COVID on, whether it's IC beds used, whether it's hospital staffing, whether it's, you know, death rates, the percentage of the populations that's afflicted, you know, that gives you a whole toolbox full of variables that you can then misapply and obfuscate, because all you need to do is present, you know, the 5 worst looking ones and ignore the rest of them. And if you can do that on a recurring basis, then you can generate panic over just about anything.
Exactly right. Let's go to a couple calls, can we? Dave is in Surprise. Hi, Dave.
Hey, thanks so much for taking the show, teacher. I appreciate it.
Oh, and thank you. I appreciate that.
Was on.
Thank you.
I've been touting your guys' methodology and statistics on Twitter the last couple months, but I want to plant a seed real quick before I get to my topic. As Lewis, you mentioned, you focus on the deaths because they don't change, but I'll just throw out there that there have been lots of different states that have actually changed their metrics for probable versus definitive death. But that's not really why I called, but that's a topic I think for another day. I think that the government, both the Arizona and the national government, have to be either complicit or complete idiots with this whole thing. I mean, we're still waiting on the CDC to develop methodology and reliable tests. This started in February, and I don't think that this is a coincidence that we can't get true data from these people.
So that's a really great point, Dave. Also about the how deaths are now being added in, whether they were suspected or confirmed deaths. Really excellent point. And I think about the only caveat I should have added to my analysis. But on the other issue, so why are we still getting bad information? You know, I think part of the issue is that, you know, as systems get built up and generated over time, they tend to ossify. They tend to harden and turn to stone. And people's professional reputations get staked on them, particularly if, you know, you've been relying on this since the beginning of the pandemic, and every day you've been going up and making the claim, you know, that we need to duck and cover effectively to protect ourselves from all of this, that, you know, we are then, you're going to run out of credibility. And so it is really very much in your interest to prevent that from happening. And rather than, you know, redirect and try to think about how can I more efficaciously give this information, how can I provide greater transparency and greater utility to people, you know, you're stuck thinking instead on how do I cover myself, how do I stop the narrative from being flipped on me, and how do I then you know, continue forward with my mission to quote unquote inform people.
Yeah. No, I think that there's a serious issue here, which is a disease that a lot of people don't know a lot about. I think the experts that we have been entrusting to give us good public health information, from which public policy practitioners, those who we have elected to represent us and, you know, give us the public policies we live under, manage our health, our policing, our safety, and that sort of thing. These experts have been wrong almost at every turn. Almost at every turn, but every time they change or every time they make a turn, we are told we must listen to them and we must take what they say seriously. And so the last time we heard Anthony Fauci say something that was highly newsworthy, it's that we were going to possibly see 100,000 cases a day in America. What was left out was all the context, and I think it's his fault for being, what's the word I want, unclear, is that we may already have that. We already may be there. And if that's the case, ironically enough, it's actually good news. Can I have you say something about that when we come back?
Let's do it.
All right. I'm Seth Leibson, 602-508-0960. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Delighted to have Lewis Hallman in the studio with us. He is the Managing Director of Insight Analytics. Let's go to Roger in Peoria. Hi, Roger. You're on with Lewis and me.
Howdy. I wanted to throw out there, you guys are talking about the deaths. I listened to Lewis and his dad last week. Very good show, by the way.
Thanks so much.
2 days. The average, or the biggest jump in cases is 20 to 41, or is it 20 to, what is the age?
It's 20 to 44.
Okay. What do you suppose the average age of these Antifa rioters was?
23.
About that, yeah.
You don't think that there's a correlation between the sudden burst of cases in their age group and the fact that they just got done having their riots a week or two ago?
Listen, Roger, a lot of us have been saying that, and yes, your point is absolutely right. I think there's no question. I mean, you saw these masses of people in the streets of major cities, from Los Angeles to Cincinnati, from Minneapolis to New York, over whom the mayors had nothing to say, by the way. Nothing to say about that. The media had very little to say about it. When people came out for, oh, say, I don't know, a Donald Trump rally, boy, were they concerned. Boy, were they scolding. But yeah, we saw a lot more people by the millions coming out in the protest ages, roughly average age 23. That's the average age. But that was mostly a millennial effect, wasn't it, Lewis?
Well, millennials are now the now oncoming Generation Z, younger generation mm-hmm. behind us.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sort of the tail end of the millennial group.
Fair enough.
But, you know, not only that, though, but young people generally have a different pace of living. You know, age, frankly, is one of the analyses that never get or one of the variables that never gets really done justice to in any kind of economic analysis. So when, you know, people are talking about wage disparities, age is something that people very rarely think about when controlling for these things. You know, different groups of people, surprise, surprise, have different ages, and ages correspond very well to what you're doing. You know, if you're very young, you're more likely out. You're very, you know, you're consuming more. Your habits are different from someone who's 55. This is part of the reason why, you know, people in that age bracket, 20 to 44, only make up about a third of our state's population, but they get 42% of the COVID tests and account for 50% of the cases in Arizona. Despite that, they are under-hospitalized at a rate of only 2.2% relative to the 5% average for the state.
Tell me something about, you wanted to say something about experts getting things wrong.
Right. It's been sort of a theme, I think, of most of our discussions on the air and off. But, you know, it occurs to me that experts almost always get things wrong. You know, it's frankly more surprising to me if they get it right than if they do get it wrong. Consider that, you know, the entire U.S. military was blindsided by the fact that the USSR collapsed when it did. We were not ready for that. We had to entirely reorient our strategy around that. That was, you know, and that was these people's jobs, was to study and figure out how to make the USSR collapse.
Right.
You would think if anyone was tuned in on the hows and the whens, it would be them.
You can think of the slam dunk out of the CIA on WMD with Saddam Hussein.
Exactly right. You know, there's all sorts of these issues. And another problem with that, though, is that we rely too often on experts who indeed may be very good on their issue of expertise. But the problem is that they're single domain experts not wizards.
That's right.
Right.
Specialists with their deep knowledge of a particular subject tend not to incorporate information outside their domain.
And what's even more interesting is there's actually a very rich academic literature talking about how if you take people who are otherwise very brilliant out of their domains, they completely fall apart.
That's right.
Even statisticians, if you get a statistician to think of things in a way that is not, you know, predicated around academic statistics and modeling, they'll make all kinds of goofy errors that, you know, you wouldn't think that they would, because they're supposed to understand this stuff. But we are very context dependent with our information.
And we keep going back to them. You know, we had the Imperial College study. What was his name? Dr. Ferguson, right?
Right. Ferguson.
Right. Neil Ferguson. We kept going back to him after case after case after case where he got it wrong. I'm in politics. I understand this very well because we have political experts on Fox, on CNN, on MSNBC. You wonder how they get contracts, how wrong they
are, how often wrong they are. Look at the whole group on the 2016 election. These guys just should be out of business, but there's never any accountability for that.
Well, there's also there's no grading score of any sort. When is the last time you've turned on the news and seen like a win-loss ratio of how often someone is correct about things?
That's
because that's not the goal. The goal is I want to get someone who seems official who agrees with me. And then will let me broadcast my views everywhere.
I want to do something fun with you about dialogue, debate, and discussion when we come back. It's a little different and off the coronavirus, but maybe part and parcel of it in its own way, too. Inviting listeners at 602-508-0960. I'm Seth. He's Lewis. We'll be right back. As I've been telling you, since October, really, I think, when Balance of Nature signed up with this show, it's the only supplement I take, and I love it. It gives me 10 servings of 31 different fruits and vegetables, energy, health, boosted immunity. My goodness, I heard the founder of the company doing an ad saying it helps your body do what it needs to do to keep you strong and healthy. It's exactly right. When you get all those apples and bananas and blueberries and carrots and spinach and kale, easily taken in vegetarian capsule, all vegetarian capsules. If you don't like vegetarian capsules, if you can't take capsules, they're easy to open. You can sprinkle them in a drink or sprinkle them on some food. It's a great product. As I say, I take it every single day. It's the only thing I take. And they have a great deal, giving you free shipping and 35% off any new preferred order of their fruits and veggies. They have a 30-day money-back guarantee, but you're not going to need 30 days to know whether it works for you or not. You'll know in about 24 to 48 hours with all that potency, just full of good stuff. Call 800-2468-751 or go to balanceofnature.com and use discount code BALANCE. One of the things, Lewis, I wanted to talk to you about, you brought in something kind of interesting. I was going to say fun, but it's actually sad. About how do we have conversations anymore when people come out with such moral certainty from a position that is so upside down, so afield from common sense and common parlance. Show, for example, let me give a for instance if I can. Show me what you did with what you found that the city of Seattle was doing. This is the city of Seattle. This is Seattle taxpayers at work. Read it to us. Tell us what's going on there.
Sure. So this is part of a training program that the city of Seattle is putting on for its white employees.
White employees.
Yes. This is interrupting IRS, which is internalized racist systems, I think. Sure. I'm not quite sure. And whiteness, the
sensibilities,
work.
Internal racist sensibilities, yeah.
Yeah, the work of white accomplices. It's about practices for the self. The one that really caught my eye was practicing self-talk that affirms our complicity in racism. Racism is not our fault, but we are responsible. Other practices are, doing your own healing work, what trauma patterns or other unwells based being cause you to be this way, you know, all sorts of these other issues. There are other pieces of material from this training platform talking about what sort of ideals or ideas, contribute to internalized racial superiority. These include such things as individualism, paternalism, intellectualization, comfort,
intellectualization,
objectivity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
so you can work for the city of Seattle and you're white, you cannot be objective.
Apparently.
Okay.
Or if you are, then it is a sign of your internalized racial superiority.
Do more of it. What else they got on that list?
Sure. So the whole list, let me see.
Yeah, give me the whole list.
All right. It's so for internalized racial superiority.
In case I go to work for the city of Seattle.
Perfectionism, individualism, imposition, arrogance, paternalism, silence, intellectualization, control, violence, comfort, appropriation, cognitive dissonance, objectivity, and anti-blackness. Curiously enough, anti-blackness is also present on the internalized racial inferiority list, which include such things as colorism, isolation, protectionism, addiction, self-doubt, self-hate, rage, shame, denial, assimilation, ethnocentrism, amusingly, distancing, exaggerated visibility, hopelessness, apathy, erasure, curiously again, invisibility, in contrast with the exaggerated visibility I just read, and again, anti-blackness.
So this is basically created, of all those things you just read, there's only two things, really only one, anti-blackness, that a rational person, a thinking human being, a cognizant human being, someone capable of ratiocination, anti-blackness would really be the only thing that we would think of as an emblem, as a mark of racism on that list. None of the other things have anything to do
with there are
racism.
Things like rage, shame,
violence,
and denial,
okay.
Which, you know...
Okay, violence, maybe.
Sure, right.
Maybe. Maybe. I mean, a lot
Not
of people
all
are
violence,
yeah.
Certainly,
right.
But a good subset.
Sure. There can be racial violence, but violence in and of itself isn't necessarily a racial act. We know this because most white crime is white on white crime. We know this because most black homicides are black on black homicides. Most violence is not racial violence. There wouldn't be a separate category of hate crimes if that were true. But the anti-blackness, but this is how we water down. This is how we vitiate. This is how we diminish.
If I actually can jump in a second,
sure.
Steph, what really concerns me is that the things that are markers of internalized racial superiority, particularly individualism, intellectualization, and objectivity, are the very foundations of science and the enlightenment that undergird the entirety of our society. All of our law is built on the fact that the individual is supreme. The
right.
Individual, in fact, is the ultimate minority, and we tread on the individual at our peril because we cannot control who the powerful are and when we may be tread on in turn. That is the whole point of the last 300 years of human history and evolution, and I am horrified that those are, you know, those many among us are willing to just crumple that into a ball. And
no, that's right. They trade it in. We've traded in individual rights for group rights. Conservatives made a mistake. Some conservatives, not me, but some and not a lot of us, but some conservatives made a mistake when they started talking about our founding was designed on behalf of states' rights. Liberals and leftists made the mistake of thinking that groups have rights or our founding was meant to protect group rights. It's not true. You read the founders, you read the Declaration of Independence, you read the Constitution, it's about individual rights.
Right. And about the states' rights portion, that's more the merits of decentralization
Correct.
And parallel systems
Correct.
Than it is affirming rights to groups.
Correct. Absolutely right. So when you get this kind of diktat from the city, from any city, from any government entity, in this case, the city of Seattle, it raises the question you were raising with me off air, which is how do you even have conversations anymore?
Well, it's very difficult. And it's hard for me in particular, I think, because I want logic to work. I want logic to triumph all. But the issue is that the logos is about the most unpersuasive form of argument that there is. We don't
hold that thought. Hold that thought. I'm going to make you deliver it as the concluding thought of the show when we come back. Okay?
Let's do it.
All right. I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be right back. Thank you for spending some of your afternoon with us. I want to have our concluding thought go to our guest, Lewis Holman. We love Greek philosophy and thinking and words here. You were talking about logos, Lewis. Give your concluding thought on the use of logos. First, define what logos is. I know it from the Aristotelian sense, which is basically reasoned discourse. There
right.
are various uses of it. Is that the phrase you use?
Exactly what I mean. So there are three basic types of argumentation. There are appeals to logos, which are reasoned discourse. There are ethos, which is sort of authority and structure. And then there's pathos,
right.
the passions, emotion. And I think I was saying that logos is about the weakest form of argumentation there is. It's very unpersuasive is the issue because it doesn't hit us at our root. It only really works after careful, quiet consideration. And even at like a neurophysiological level, this is true because we are more acted upon much more quickly. In fact, orders of magnitude more quickly by our reactions to things than our top-down thoughts about those things. So if you, you know, are angry with something, you are going to be angry with them more quickly than you can talk yourself down about that anger. And so it logos always sort of starts itself off on the back foot is sort of the issue that it has, which is just absolutely frustrating. Because it means then that we have to reach people other ways. We have to be friendly. We have to be courteous to one another. And we can't play as if we're just trying to win. That can be occasionally useful. But what we have to do is sit down with one another and have the slow, long conversations that it takes to actually, you know, talk about what our presuppositions are. Why do I believe, you know, what I believe? Why do you believe what you believe? And in fact, come to the mutual realization that we don't necessarily hate one another. We just have alternate and sometimes conflicting visions of what the good is.
Yeah, I think what the millennial and younger generations missed is that the individual,
most of them anyway,
most of them is collectively, yeah, is that the individual right to freedom of thought and freedom of assembly and freedom to petition the government for a redress of grievances peaceably, by the way, doesn't mean that the other side, those who are they are entreating or petitioning, have to agree. I think too many of them mean that their view must prevail. And the competition that comes from logos, from dialogue, and from reason, and from debate is a competition of ideas.